The Deep Dive. The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, December 13th, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
Today, we are taking a deep dive into just an absolutely sprawling stack of source material.
Yeah.
Our mission, really, is to extract and synthesize the most critical decisions that are shaping the world right now.
Yeah, and we're talking about everything from, you know, high-stakes financial appointments in D.C. all the way to a massive military buildup in the Caribbean.
And even down to the sheer absurdity of million-dollar fish discos in Britain.
Mm.
We're aiming to give you a comprehensive and exhaustive understanding of today's critical news.
It's a day that's really defined by pivotal choices and, frankly, existential risks. We're tracking political leaders who are attempting to reshape traditionally independent institutions.
Whether it's the Federal Reserve or, you know, the actual architecture of the White House itself.
Exactly. And we'll show how those domestic tensions are reflected in the shifting sands of global conflict, especially as we look at the future of warfare against, well, peer adversaries.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately. We have to start right at the heart of power in Washington, the battle for the Federal Reserve chairmanship. This is so much more than just a personnel choice.
Oh, absolutely. It's a decision that will define the trajectory of the U.S. economy for the next 4 years.
And our sources confirm President Trump's preferences are leaning heavily toward one of two men, either former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh or the National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett.
That's right. And there's a really fascinating subtlety here. For quite a while, Kevin Hassett, who, you know, brings a PhD in economics, served as a senior economic advisor from 2017 to 2019. He was widely considered the internal frontrunner.
Especially after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent made it clear he just wasn't interested in the job.
Mm-hmm.
But the detail check from the Journal suggests Warsh is actually the one at the top of the list now.
Mm.
Trump even confirmed it, saying, yes, I think he is. I think you have Kevin and Kevin. They're both, I think the two Kevins are great.
He's holding a final round of interviews, though. So current Fed governors Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman are also in the mix.
But what stands out here and what is just profoundly influencing this whole process is the president's insistence on a specific policy outcome. He wants immediate and steep rate cuts.
The political pressure is. It's palpable. He confirmed that during a 45-minute meeting this week, he pressed Warsh directly on whether he would support cutting interest rates if he were chosen. I mean, that's just unprecedented in modern Fed history.
And the president's motivation for this is remarkably specific. It's financially driven. He told the Journal that within a year, he wants interest rates at 1% and maybe lower than that.
And this isn't just about stimulating the economy in a general sense.
No, it's primarily about managing the national debt. He needs those rate cuts to help the U.S. Treasury drastically reduce the financing costs on that enormous, growing $30 trillion government debt. He wants the U.S. to have the lowest rate in the world.
And if you connect that to the bigger picture, this signals a major and, I mean, some would argue, a very dangerous attempt to erode the political independence of the central bank.
Right. He insisted the next Fed chair should routinely consult with him on where to set interest rates. He said, quote, typically, that's not done anymore. It used to be done routinely. It should be done. And then he added, I am a smart voice and should be listened to.
Wait a minute, though. Isn't the entire global financial structure built on the premise that the U.S. central bank is independent of political cycles?
Exactly. If he forces the next chair to consult with him, doesn't that fundamentally risk destroying the very market trust and independence that keeps U.S. assets and the dollar itself so attractive globally, especially when other central banks are still trying to fight inflation?
That's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? The fear among orthodox economists is precisely that. Trump's desire for influence, it stems from this personalized, very deep frustration with the current Fed leadership, especially Jerome Powell, whom he picked in 2017.
And Trump's core frustration is that financial markets have gotten used to the Fed being worried about raising rates whenever the economy looks stronger than expected, you know, the classic inflation fight.
Right. He explicitly said, I won't have anybody on the Federal Reserve that when you have good news, that means you automatically raise interest rates through the roof in order to kill inflation. This highly personalized interventionist approach, I mean, it signals a volatile future for monetary policy, regardless of who he chooses.
And all this political pressure is arriving at a moment when the Federal Reserve itself is, well, visibly fracturing. The sources highlight that contentious 9-3 vote this week to cut the benchmark rate by a quarter point.
Right, moving the range to 3.5% to 3.75%. Three dissenting votes. That's the most we've seen since 2019. It tells you just how hard it is for them to build consensus right now.
It's the return of a 15-year-old dilemma that Powell himself articulated. They're stuck between two opposing forces.
On one hand, you've got stubborn inflation, which usually demands higher interest rates to cool things down. On the other, a softening job market that suggests the economy needs lower rates to avoid a recession.
Powell summed up the impossibility of it. He said, you've got one tool. You can't do two things at once.
So let's get into those dissenting views, because they really reveal the internal tension. You have Kansas City Fed President Jeff Schmid, who vehemently opposed the cut.
He sees significant underlying economic momentum and thinks inflation is still, in his words, too hot.
For Schmid, the policy just isn't restrictive enough, and easing up now risks letting inflation get really entrenched.
Then you have Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee. He also opposed, but his concern was more tactical. He wants cuts later, but he's urging caution now because inflation is so stubborn. He said the Fed needs to just get the dust out of the air before making another move.
And then on the other side, you have the argument for cuts, which was led by Philadelphia Fed President Anna Paulson. She's focused heavily on labor market weakness.
She saw the cumulative cuts, 0.75 total, as necessary insurance against further labor market deterioration.
Right. She explicitly said she is a little more concerned about labor market weakness than about upside risks to inflation, because she believes inflation will naturally cool down next year as housing costs slow and, you know, those previous tariff effects finally fade out.
So if we look ahead, what's the practical implication of this? I mean, the sources mention it. Two of the regional presidents coming onto the voting committee next year, Beth Hanick of the Cleveland Fed and Lori Logan of Dallas, have already signaled they're cautious about easing rates further.
It means the policy uncertainty isn't going away, even if Schmid and Goolsbee rotate off the voting committee. Hanick, in particular, has publicly supported the idea that a more restrictive stance is still warranted.
So the internal debate is shifting from should we cut to how much more restrictive do we need to be to make sure inflation is truly dead?
Exactly. The next Fed chair, whoever it is going to inherit a deeply fractured committee that's trying to navigate an economic landscape with a lot of conflicting signals.
Moving from domestic fiscal pressures to some acute geopolitical pressure points, let's pivot to Venezuela. Our sources are detailing a massive, almost breathtaking escalation of U.S. military power being moved into the Caribbean Sea.
This is a profound shift in U.S. foreign policy. After weeks of sort of limited, low-level skirmishes, you know, deadly boat strikes, the seizure of an oil tanker, The Trump administration is clearly shifting its focus.
So the goal is no longer just deterrence.
No. The goal now is to establish the capability to conduct full-scale land strikes, disable defenses, and enforce an oil embargo against Nicolas Maduro and his regime.
Let's talk specifics, because the asset deployment is really staggering. This isn't just a few ships.
No. We are talking about F-35A stealth jet fighters, Growler electronic warfare planes, which are critical for jamming enemy communications.
HH-60W rescue helicopters, HC-130J rescue planes staged in Puerto Rico. They've also moved tanker aircraft to the Dominican Republic, which allows bombers to refuel in midair.
And you can't forget the USS Gerald R. Ford carrier, which arrived last month. This entire array of military force, it poses a direct existential threat, not just to Maduro's regime, but also to his key allies.
The sources specifically mention Cuba.
Right, which is severely reliant on Venezuelan oil. Disrupting that relationship is a central part of the pressure strategy.
So what would be the likely first step if kinetic action is actually authorized?
Well, analysts suggest the initial operations would be subtle but crippling. Things like cyber warfare and satellite jamming. You see, Venezuela operates some relatively sophisticated Russian-built air defense systems.
So the goal would be able to disable those systems without firing a shot.
Exactly. It opens up the battle space for precision, stealthy strikes by U.S. forces. It's a tactical evolution, really, aimed at minimizing risk to American personnel.
The regional implications here are, they're enormous and, frankly, terrifying. Evan and Romero, he's an energy consultant in Houston, noted that if the U.S. successfully enforces an oil embargo and removes that critical oil supply from Venezuela, we could be looking at the final collapse of the nation.
And that collapse is precisely what regional analysts are warning could spiral into a wider Latin American crisis. It could lead to a devastating civil war, destabilize neighboring countries, create an enormous refugee crisis.
The sources really underline the immediate tension. Port officials in Venezuela have already reported seeing anti-aircraft guns being deployed near the second largest airport in Valencia.
And over 80% of flights have been canceled in the past 2 weeks. Ship traffic is nearly at a standstill. I mean, the whole region is just holding its breath.
And against that backdrop of massive military pressure and systemic breakdown, we have this incredible high-stakes story of the daring extraction of the Venezuelan opposition leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Maria Corina Machado.
This really does read like a geopolitical thriller. Machado had been living in hiding since she was barred from running in the 2024 election. And the operation to get her out, they dubbed it Operation Golden Dynamite. It took 3 grueling days and nearly failed almost immediately.
The mission was led by a guy named Brian Stern, a U.S. combat veteran who runs an organization staffed by former special ops and intelligence veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Machado, wearing a wig and a disguise, traveled overland to this remote fishing village. And then she boarded a small, rundown fishing skiff.
And they chose that specifically because its appearance wouldn't look like the drug smuggling boats that the U.S. military has been targeting and bombing in the region.
Right. So the goal was a 12-hour journey to a rendezvous point in the Caribbean.
And that's where the crisis hit. For 3 hours, the skiff just drifted in 10-foot waves because its GPS fell overboard and the backup navigation system failed.
So Stern's team is frantically trying to locate her in the dark, and they eventually find the skiff 25 miles off the agreed-upon meeting point. The tension must have been immense. Stern described his own boat as a sitting duck for Venezuelan security forces.
What's fascinating is the coordination, or maybe the non-coordination, with the U.S. government. The mission was privately funded, but U.S. officials, we're talking senior military commanders, White House staff, State Department diplomats, they monitored the entire journey in real time.
Stern sent them a crucial proof of life photo, and they communicated through encrypted WhatsApp messages and voice memos.
Stone's message to his U.S. defense officials really encapsulated how precarious it was. He said, number one, keep an eye on us. Number two, don't kill us.
So you have the U.S. government watching this active, high-risk, privately funded extraction of a key political dissident in a region that's teeming with U.S. military assets.
It's incredible. Machado was ultimately transferred to a private jet in Curaçao and flown to Oslo. Her escape just vividly illustrates the extreme dangers faced by political dissenters under a regime that's teetering on the brink of collapse.
The sheer complexity of that political survival story, where the stakes are literally life or death, it brings us back to Washington, where political survival hinges on policy and legislative success, or in the case of healthcare, profound failure.
The transition works because it highlights the universal difficulty of political execution. Domestically, we have the continuing saga that our sources are correctly calling the Republican healthcare nightmare.
This decade-long failure of the GOP to effectively replace or even unwind the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And this past week gave us 2 very concrete examples of this failure in the Senate, which significantly increases the likelihood that millions of Americans are going to see premium hikes next year.
Which, of course, hands the Democrats a massive midterm campaign issue. First, a Republican proposal to replace ACA subsidies with direct federal funds for out-of-pocket costs failed.
And second, a Democratic proposal to extend the enhanced COVID-era ACA subsidies for 3 years also failed to pass. Now, while the Democratic proposal needed 60 votes, it's highly notable that it attracted 4 Republicans.
Right. Senators Murkowski, Sullivan, Collins, and Hawley. The fact that the vote was even that contentious signals the deep fracture inside the party.
And these legislative failures are just immediate political gold for Democrats. They're already planning to make this the centerpiece of their efforts. Polls show they hold a massive 23-point advantage over the GOP on which party is best equipped to handle health care.
The GOP's problem isn't just messaging, though. It's fundamental economics, isn't it?
It is. They're ideologically committed to the belief that market-based coverage should prevail over expensive government programs. Their standard proposal centers on health savings accounts, HSAs. But for voters who actually need expensive care, the plan just falls apart.
Why is that?
Because the proposed GOP plan might put, say, $1,500 into an HSA, but high-deductible plans that are common in the market can require families to pay $10,000 or more before their insurance even kicks in.
So their solution just doesn't address the affordability problem for the vast number of Americans who are only one major illness away from bankruptcy.
Exactly. And the political reality is that many Republican voters now rely on Obamacare coverage. This conundrum is forcing some Republicans to break ranks, like Senator Hawley, who expressed a willingness to work on something.
So they're trying to dismantle a system that their own constituents have become dependent on, and the political cost of that failure is just rising exponentially.
Meanwhile, the administration is engaged in a literal turf war right outside the Oval Office, one that involves both historic preservation and DC's public golf courses. This is a fascinating one.
It begins with a lawsuit. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has filed to halt the construction of President Trump's planned expansive ballroom, which will be attached to the White House East Wing.
The preservation group alleges that the planned demolition and construction, which would add at least 90,000 square feet to the complex, violates federal laws. These laws require outside input on environmental, historic, and aesthetic impacts.
So they're arguing that no president is legally allowed to just tear down portions of the White House without a proper review.
Right. And this is where the story gets really interesting because it connects politics with, well, with dirt. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum came up with what the president called a brilliant idea.
Which was?
Use the dirt from the East Wing demolition, and it's a substantial amount of dirt, as fill for the renovation of the low-ground East Potomac golf links. That public complex needs fill to raise it above the Potomac River floodplain.
So this dirt dilemma is now being used as leverage in a much bigger battle over access to public amenities.
It is. Trump is actively moving to sideline the National Links Trust. That's a nonprofit group that holds a 50-year lease to restore and operate the city's three historic public courses, East Potomac, Rock Creek Park Golf, and Langston Golf Course.
And Langston has deep historical significance for Black golfers, right?
It does. And the mission of the National Links Trust is explicit: to keep the sport, which is often very elite, affordable, and accessible to D.C. residents. Green fees at East Potomac, for instance, range from $9 to $47.
But Trump has a different vision. He wants a world-class destination, which Secretary Burgum has suggested rebranding as the Washington National Golf Course.
And the administration used the nonprofit's decision to accept the East Wing demolition dirt as an excuse to issue a formal default notice to the trust, which could potentially terminate their lease.
So he's leveraging dirt to take over a golf course.
Pretty much. Trump told the Journal that if the nonprofit doesn't address the alleged lease violations by the end of the month, the courses will revert to the administration's control. Critics fear this will inevitably lead to increased costs, making the courses less accessible.
And although Trump promised D.C. residents would pay a lower rate, the move is seen as reflecting a broader disdain for bureaucratic norms, especially since he recently overhauled the National Capital Planning Commission to install loyalists.
Speaking of pay and bureaucracy, we have an interesting story about Amtrak, where executives are literally subsidizing frontline workers.
It's a highly unique maneuver and one that's clearly driven by the administration's focus on executive compensation.
That's right. Over 18,000 unionized Amtrak frontline workers are going to receive a $900 bonus. And this bonus is being funded by 246 Amtrak managers who agreed to forego about $16.2 million of their bonus packages this year.
And this came after the Transportation Department had explicitly criticized Amtrak's previous incentive pay system as exorbitant payouts for senior staff.
All while the rail operator was running billions in losses. Yeah.
Shifting to broader federal employment rights, the House passed the bill 231 to 195, and this vote included 20 Republicans joining the Democrats.
Which is significant.
To reverse a Trump executive order that had stripped collective bargaining rights from roughly 1 million federal workers at agencies like the VA and the FDA.
This is a major philosophical collision between government efficiency and worker rights. Supporters of the executive order argue that these labor agreements reduce efficiency, making it incredibly difficult to reward merit or punish poor performance.
And they say it slows down critical functions, like pharmaceutical reviews. They often point to the lengthy and frustrating disciplinary processes at the VA as a result of a highly unionized workforce.
But the concern from the other side is historical. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt himself, a champion of unions in the private sector, worried that collective bargaining for federal workers might undermine the government's duty to serve the whole people, rather than just one segment.
The fact that 20 Republicans broke ranks suggests that even within the GOP, this debate over how to balance accountability with the right to organize is highly contentious.
We also have two significant flashpoints in immigration law this week, highlighting the tension between judicial authority and enforcement action.
The first involves a man named Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran who had previously been wrongfully deported to a notorious prison in El Salvador. A federal judge had ordered his release, but then had to act again just hours later.
Right. Federal Judge Paula Sheenis blocked U.S. immigration authorities from re-detaining him, citing a real fear that ICE officials would immediately take him back into custody during a scheduled appointment, basically circumventing her initial release order.
So his lawyers sent an urgent request, and the judge agreed. She wrote that for the public to have faith in the orderly administration of justice, the court's remedy cannot be so quickly and easily upended.
It's a signal of the court's determination that he has strong merits for further relief from detention.
The second case involves Heng Guan, a Chinese citizen journalist who is now at severe risk of removal. He fled China after gathering evidence of alleged human rights violations against the Uyghur population.
And he was detained by ICE in upstate New York. Guan was detained back in August during a standard ICE operation, but the target was actually his roommate. His lawyer notes that his online hearing this week will be his first chance to state his full case for asylum.
And human rights groups are gravely concerned because returning him to China would put him at severe risk, given his journalistic efforts back in 2020 to check Western media reports about the mass imprisonment and abuse of ethnic Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
These domestic and geopolitical pressures, they bring us to the very opaque world of global finance, where the very structure of wealth generation is creating enormous systemic disparities. This is an essential section for you, the listener, to understand.
This section really explains why the rich seem to be pulling away so quickly. The stock market, in many ways, is becoming invitation only. The number of U.S. public companies has been halved since its peak in the late 1990s. This is a profound structural shift.
Let's use a great historical contrast from the sources. When Amazon went public in 1997, it was valued at roughly $400 million, only 3 years after it was founded.
And $1,000 invested back then would be worth over $3 million today.
But today, companies are waiting far, far longer. The median age for a company going public is now 14 years old. It was 6 in the year 2000.
And the reason they wait is simple, isn't it? They can secure enormous funding privately, and they get to circumvent all the stringent disclosure rules and public scrutiny that come with public markets.
It creates this privileged, invitation-only tier of early investment. For example, the ultra-wealthy are accessing early shares of booming companies like OpenAI, which had a $40 billion offering, where fewer than 50 hand-picked investors snagged shares.
And SpaceX recently hit an $800 billion valuation in a private tender offer.
So the everyday investor, the one saving for retirement in a 401k, is completely excluded from that critical, explosive growth phase. They're left with older, slower-growing names that have already matured.
This is clearly exacerbating wealth disparity. It's captured perfectly by SEC Chairman Paul Atkins, who asked, "Does this mean the rich get richer while the non-rich should be content to just hold their place on the economic ladder?"
And the implications go beyond just wealth. It changes capital formation, it limits the liquidity of early employees, and it stifles public participation in innovation.
So Atkins is trying to entice more companies to go public and widen access to private markets, partly by making it easier to include private markets in retirement plans. But this brings us to the serious risks of the secondary private market.
Right. Accredited investors, those with a million in net assets or 200,000 in annual income, who miss that initial private funding round, often have to buy shares through these convoluted structures called SPVs.
Okay, so what exactly is an SPV?
An SPV is a special purpose vehicle. Think of it as a temporary layered shell company created for a single transaction. Instead of owning stock directly in, say, SpaceX, you own an interest in a small fund. That's the first SPV. That small fund, in turn, owns exposure to a larger vehicle, the second SPV, which then finally owns exposure to the company's actual shares.
It sounds incredibly opaque and just prone to high fees and abuse.
It is. This layering leads to fees and a lack of transparency that would never be tolerated in public markets. The result is a secondary market that is rife with fraud and bad actors, as the co-founder of defense startup Endural recently complained.
He argued that bottom feeders are profiting off their growth by fleecing retail investors through unreasonable or opaque fee structures.
We've already seen instances of catastrophic fraud here, too. The sources highlight the company Linkto, which promised small investor shares in successful private companies like Ripple and Anthropic, sometimes marking them up by as much as 60%.
But an internal investigation found customers never actually owned the securities.
No. Linkto has now filed for bankruptcy, leaving investors holding the bag.
SEC Commissioner Caroline Crenshaw's warning seems prophetic here. She said, "We are headed for a high-speed collision with Main Street retail investors left without airbags."
And despite these risks, Wall Street firms like Charles Schwab and Morgan Stanley are acquiring platforms specializing in these secondary private stock marketplaces. They're hoping to standardize this convoluted sector and collect massive fees if it continues to grow.
And, crucially, if the Trump administration successfully widens access for the average investor.
That commercial tension is mirrored in some dramatic corporate shifts this week, starting with a hostile takeover bid that is reshaping the entire streaming landscape.
This is the massive M&A saga surrounding Warner Bros. Discovery. Paramount Skydance made a dramatic hostile takeover bid valued at $77.9 billion for all of WBD.
Which escalates the battle against their streaming rival, Netflix.
Right. Netflix had previously offered $72 billion, but only for WBD Studios and the highly valuable HBO Max streaming business, intentionally leaving the declining cable network assets behind.
So Paramount is arguing its all-cash offer for the entire company is a better deal for shareholders, and maybe more importantly, is more likely to pass regulatory muster. It doesn't involve the same anti-competitive concerns as combining two massive streaming production houses.
So the fight for dominance in the streaming era is moving beyond just pricing and into who can amass the largest content libraries.
Mm-hmm. Shifting to retail, Lululemon is undergoing a major leadership change. CEO Calvin McDonald is set to step down in January amid faltering sales.
And the sources link this to founder Chip Wilson's private frustration over the company's perceived loss of cool.
Ironically, Lululemon shares jumped 9.6% on the news of McDonald's departure, which signals that investors may see his exit as a necessary step to recapture the brand's luxury, performance-focused identity.
On the pharmaceutical side, Eli Lilly continues its impressive run. They reported significant success with their next-generation weight loss drug, Retatrutide.
Yeah, clinical trials showed patients on the highest dose averaged 28.7% weight loss,
which is significantly more than existing drugs like their own Zepbound and Mounjaro.
It is. This success potentially allows Lilly to sustain its booming market presence and maintain its commanding lead in that competitive and massively lucrative weight loss drug space.
In a surprising bright spot for GameStop, which has faced declining hardware and software sales, their collectibles business is booming.
That's right. Trading cards, toys, action figures, all of that increased 50% to $256.1 million in the quarter.
That collectible segment now makes up nearly a third of GameStop's total revenue, up from 20% the year before.
It suggests that while the physical media sales model is dying, the nostalgic retail experience, augmented by high-value collectibles, may be the only long-term path for the meme stock darling.
And here's a detail showing how political decisions hit the average consumer. Campbell's reported its sales are being drained by President Trump's tariffs during what they call the critical soup season,
which contributed to a 5.2% drop in shares, despite otherwise decent results. The tariffs raise raw material costs, forcing them to raise consumer prices, which just leads to lower volumes of soup sold.
Finally, we have the bizarre corporate contradiction from Disney. They are investing $1 billion in OpenAI and licensing over 200 characters, including Marvel, Star Wars, and Pixar, for use on Sora, OpenAI's short-form AI video platform.
But wait, didn't Disney just accuse Google and its AI of massive copyright infringement this week?
They did. They are simultaneously licensing their intellectual property to one AI giant while suing another for IP theft.
It signals a company grappling with the reality that AI is here to stay. They're choosing to hedge their bets by engaging with a technology that has the highest promise while aggressively defending its legacy content through litigation.
That tension between innovation and intellectual property, between human intuition and machine reliability, is absolutely central to our next segment, which looks at the emerging era of technology and trust.
The sources outline a profound philosophical paradox here. We exhibit a massive trust deficit when it comes to AI. We tolerate the opacity and the known fallibility of human decision-making, whether it's a judge or a driver, but we fundamentally distrust auditable, transparent AI systems.
We see this so clearly in autonomous vehicles. Chris Urmson, the CEO of Aurora Innovation, which develops self-driving truck software, made a staggering claim. He said his AI driver, according to their models, would have avoided every single fatal collision studied on Interstate 45 in Texas from 2018 through 2022.
That's a measurable, demonstrable safety improvement.
Yet, even after putting their driverless trucks on the road in Texas, Aurora had to bring human observers back into the cabs within weeks, specifically at the request of one of its manufacturing partners.
That highlights that corporate anxiety and public perception often override demonstrable AI performance data. The fear of being the first to have a catastrophic, highly publicized, fully autonomous accident is often greater than the desire for proven safety.
We see a parallel phenomenon in the legal world with the American Arbitration Association's new AI arbitrator. Former Michigan Supreme Court Justice Bridget Mary McCormick, she runs a AAA, and has touted this system for document-only cases.
And it provides complete transparency. It literally shows its work, allowing the parties to audit every single step of the machine's logic.
Experts, including professional arbitrators and judges, have tested it and found it reliable. But here's the rub. Since its debut last month, no one has opted to use the AI arbitrator in a real-life case.
Despite being fully transparent, auditable, and demonstrably reliable, humans still prefer the judgment of an opaque, potentially fallible human judge.
But why do we have this distrust, even when the machine is showing us its work?
Well, it stems partly from early, widely reported failures. Think back to the racially biased sentencing algorithms in U.S. court systems. Those failures force companies into what algorithmic auditor Kathy O'Neill calls involuntary transparency.
So when companies had to hand over internal records to regulators or opposing counsel, the digitized process generated these vast amounts of auditable data that exposed the flaws.
Precisely. And O'Neill notes that this involuntary transparency forces auditors to focus on the impact, the distribution of decisions, rather than just the process itself. She is cautiously optimistic, noting that algorithmic accountability is one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement remaining in Washington because both sides realize the systemic risks of opaque automation.
From AI and society, let's pivot sharply to AI and conflict. The U.S. Army is fundamentally changing its tools and tactics to prepare for a potential great power conflict with a near-peer adversary like China in the Indo-Pacific.
This is a profound institutional shift away from two decades of counterinsurgency in the Middle East. And the fundamental premise of the new strategy is simple. The U.S. cannot expect to rule the skies against China, which possesses a massive missile arsenal and unrivaled industrial strength.
So therefore, the Army must become lighter, faster, and more dispersed.
Right. The sources stress the shift to boats, buggies light, maneuverable vehicles, and bombardment, focusing on shoot-and-scoot HIMARS missile platforms. 16 HIMARS arrived in Hawaii this year alone as part of this pivot.
The new modern battlefield, as the sources detail it, focuses heavily on the air littorals. This is a crucial concept for you to understand.
The air littoral is that low-altitude airspace, the zone between the ground and the high skies, where cheap, expendable drones now lurk and swarm.
And during massive exercises in Hawaii last month, involving over 8,000 personnel, troops were training with new tech against new tech, specifically in this dangerous low-altitude environment.
Specialist Josiah Witt, a 20-year-old soldier, described the pace of change as just insane, going from learning one type of drone to experimenting with 70 different types in about a year.
So what new gear are they using to combat this drone threat?
They're experimenting with technologies that integrate counter-drone capability into standard gear. This includes M4 assault rifles equipped with smart shooter add-ons that can automatically lock onto a flying drone target before the soldier fires.
And they're also using wearable drone blockers. The wingman detects incoming drones, and the pit bull disrupts them via an electromagnetic arrow.
The pit bull sounds like something straight out of science fiction.
It does, but Major General James Bartholomew, commander of the 25th Infantry Division, offered a crucial caveat, which he learned from observing Ukraine. Jamming a drone means showing yourself on the electromagnetic spectrum.
It's a very high-stakes game of cat and mouse where every action carries an immediate risk of detection.
And they're also learning to use these tools offensively. The troops are practicing kamikaze-style attacks, using swarms of 3D-printed quadcopters. Svistin First Class Kamikaze Kalani Mantamita said watching the drones swoop down for the kill is very, very terrifying, to be frank.
This brings us to the strategic implication that is keeping analysts up at night, the production deficit. Analysts like Benjamin Jensen fear the U.S. lacks deep enough magazine depth.
Right now, Ukraine and Russia are producing millions of drones annually for their conflict.
And China has the industrial capacity to outproduce both of them combined. If this is the future of warfare, cheap, expendable, mass-produced drones, the U.S. military-industrial complex is just currently not structured to compete.
Speaking of Ukraine, we have frontline reports that directly contradict President Trump's view that Ukraine is losing the war, suggesting resilience remains high despite Russia's grinding advances.
Yeah, Ukrainian officers and intelligence chiefs vehemently deny Russia is on the verge of a breakthrough. While marginal advances are being made, they come at an extremely heavy cost. Lieutenant General Kirilo Budanov, Ukraine's military intelligence chief, stated that Ukrainian forces are far from losing their capacity to repel Russia.
He said there is a relatively stable front line and breaking through it is extremely difficult.
And President Zelensky reinforced this defiance by filming a video near the besieged city of Kupiansk, stating that the reality speaks for itself, just as explosions echoed behind him. This was filmed ahead of critical talks with European leaders and U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff.
That show of resilience is necessary to maintain diplomatic leverage with allies who are contemplating reducing aid.
And what's fascinating is Ukraine's continued innovation strategy, particularly in covert operations. After the Bucha massacre in 2022, Ukrainian intelligence officials told their Western counterparts they would professionalize covert operations on the highly effective Mossad model.
So what does that look like tactically?
Outgunned, they've ruthlessly exploited their unique advantages. Many Ukrainians speak fluent Russian and have Russian passports, allowing agents to blend seamlessly into Russian society for intelligence gathering and sabotage.
And the sources note that rampant corruption inside Russia further aids access, procurement, and the ability of these agents to operate with surprising effectiveness behind enemy lines.
That brings us to other significant international power plays, specifically a rare U.S. Special Operations raid in the Indian Ocean.
Right. U.S. Special Ops teams boarded a ship in the Indian Ocean last month and seized military-related articles that were destined for Iran from China.
And this rare interdiction was part of a broader Pentagon effort to disrupt Iran's clandestine military procurement. This follows heavy damage inflicted on its nuclear and missile facilities during that 12-day conflict back in June.
So what exactly was the cargo they seized?
It consisted of dual-use items, components, potentially useful for Iran's advanced missile program, and it was subsequently destroyed. This marked the first time in recent memory that the U.S. military is known to have intercepted Chinese-origin cargo specifically bound for Iran.
So it highlights a focus on disrupting the supply chains, feeding regional instability.
Exactly. The other major international story involves the ongoing hunt for one of the most brutal war crime suspects of the Syrian civil war, Major General Jamil Hassan.
He was the former head of Air Force Intelligence and is considered an architect of the Assad regime's reign of terror.
Hassan is notorious for his extreme rhetoric and cruelty. He's the man who publicly warned in 2011, "I will keep killing to keep Bashar al-Assad in power. I will kill half the country if I have to." He openly cited the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre as a model.
He believed that if the regime had killed more people at the outset, the rebellion would have been crushed sooner.
When the Assad regime collapsed last December, Hassan fled. He is now one of the world's most hunted war crime suspects. He's wanted by the FBI for the alleged kidnapping and torture of American citizens, and he was convicted in absentia in France for crimes against humanity.
Former detainees have provided harrowing descriptions of seeing him personally directing torture at Mess Airbase.
And he's currently suspected to be hiding in Lebanon. His capture represents a critical step in Syria's difficult road to reckoning with the violence of the civil war.
These high-level geopolitical and political crises lead us to some social and cultural turbulence closer to home, where high-profile crimes are forcing institutions to rethink how they manage risk and liability.
We have a fascinating report on the new threat facing museums globally. The threat is shifting from the high visibility but low damage resource drain caused by climate change activists throwing food at masterpieces to brazen armed theft.
We've seen two recent dramatic examples. The first was at the Louvre in Paris 2 months ago, where thieves made off with Napoleon-era jewels in a meticulously planned 7-minute spree.
The second was just last Sunday at the Mario de Andrade Public Library in São Paulo, where two gunmen stole 8 Henri Matisse prints and 5 Candido Portinari prints. Both incidents involved weapons and direct threats to staff.
This shift has security directors inundated with calls for immediate risk assessments. The response is multi-layered, including installing anonymous tip lines to combat infraud.
Or insider fraud, which experts say accounts for anywhere from 50% to 80% of museum-related thefts.
And technology is being deployed, of course. Systems are being upgraded with AI that can watch up to 300 cameras simultaneously for anomalies, like visitors lingering too long or moving into restricted zones.
The São Paulo library theft particularly highlighted vulnerabilities in high-crime downtown areas. The library had only alarm sensors for barcoded books, and the lone unarmed guard was simply flashed a gun by the thieves.
It highlights the vast disparity in security standards between major national museums and smaller regional institutions.
But there's a bizarre coda to the São Paulo story. An art expert suggested that the cry might actually add value to the relatively lesser-known Portinari prints through the international exposure generated by the theft.
Referencing the value boost the Mona Lisa received after its famous 1911 theft.
Right. Crime adding value. A strange paradox of the art world.
Shifting to college athletics, we have the stunning and utterly chaotic escalation involving former Michigan head coach Sherrone Moore. He went from leading one of the most celebrated football programs to being arrested on felony charges in less than 24 hours.
Wait, so the arrest and the firing happened on the same day? The entire situation just unraveled in less than 24 hours. That speaks to a massive institutional and public safety failure.
The timeline is incredible. Moore was fired by the university on Wednesday for cause, based on an alleged 2-year inappropriate sexual relationship with a female staff member, which was a clear violation of university policy.
And the situation had been brewing internally for 2 months, but on Wednesday, the woman contacted the outside law firm hired by the university and provided the email, text, and phone records that confirmed the relationship.
And then the situation immediately spiraled outside the athletic department's control.
Absolutely. Police were called that afternoon to investigate an alleged assault at the woman's home. Emergency dispatch audio reported a man had entered and attacked her and also threatened self-harm, stating he did put a knife to his throat.
Moore was subsequently arrested that day, charged with a felony count of home invasion and 2 misdemeanors, including stalking. He was released on $25,000 bond.
The sources revealed that the relationship lasted from roughly 2022 to 2024, and sometime after Moore became head coach in early 2024, the woman received a significant raise. This entire episode showcases not only a massive policy failure, but a public safety crisis that unfolded with horrifying speed.
On the commercial side of crime, we shift focus to high-end retail and a case of any fraud involving a luxury stylist known as the Fashion Whisperer of Boston.
That sounds like a nickname you don't want to lose. Suhail Quatra, a stylist at Saks Fifth Avenue in Boston for 20 years, is accused of stealing over $400,000 from the retailer.
And his alleged mechanism of fraud was processing fraudulent returns.
Right. Specifically, Quatra would process returns on expensive items that wealthy clients ordered but never actually picked up. He then converted those funds into gift cards, which he used for personal purchases, some of which he allegedly wore in his social media posts.
His handwritten confession pegged the total loss at $429,400, including $375,000 from the fraudulent returns.
However, Quatra's lawyer, Jennifer Fury, has launched a compelling defense, claiming the confession was signed under duress and that his actions were condoned by supervisors. She argues the distribution of gift cards and perks was standard practice to entice high-value clients to continue shopping at Saks.
And that Saks is retaliating against him because he was contemplating employment elsewhere.
Right. Regardless of the defense's merit, this is a major embarrassment for Saks, a retailer that is already struggling financially. The case highlights how crucial high-end personal relationships are in luxury retail, but also how susceptible they are to insider abuse.
Moving across the Atlantic, we encounter an example of environmental regulatory absurdity that is effectively paralyzing infrastructure in Britain. The fight over the fish disco.
This involves EDF, the French company building the massive $61 billion Hinkley Point C nuclear plant in the UK.
The scale of the issue is immense. The cooling system for the plant is designed to suck in the equivalent of an Olympic swimming pool's worth of water every few seconds. This risks killing millions of fish, including the endangered tweed shad.
So to offset this, environmental regulators have mandated that EDF must spend a colossal $930 million on mitigation systems.
And those mitigation systems include an underwater escalator, a 2,000-foot-long fish tube, and the elaborate fish disco. What in the world is a fish disco?
It's an elaborate noise machine that must blare sounds louder than a jumbo jet 24 hours a day for 60 years. The intent is to confuse and repel the fish away from the intake tunnels.
But here is the regulatory nightmare. Different species respond to different tunes. Trout need low bass frequencies. Eels respond better to flashing lights.
And the high-frequency noises used to deter shad might harm dolphins.
So EDF has to essentially become a DJ trying to save marine life, customizing the soundscape for a population that doesn't share a universal musical taste.
Exactly, and at a cost of tens of millions of dollars to construct and maintain. EDF is balking, citing an independent report that found the original disco plan would save only minimal numbers of fish, for example, one salmon every 12 years.
This whole debate just symbolizes the bureaucratic chaos in Britain, where complex environmental regulations repeatedly delay or block vital infrastructure projects.
We've seen similar absurdities, right? Like the reports of building immensely expensive tunnels for bats for road projects.
That's the classic parallel. They were building a cathedral-sized mesh hemisphere bat tunnel for a road project that was estimated to cost roughly $500,000 per rare Bechstein's bat. The Fish Disco is just the latest, loudest example of bureaucracy prioritizing complexity over proven results.
On a completely different note in the world of sports, we have the genuinely inspiring story of the unprecedented comeback of Lindsey Vonn.
At 41 years old, Vonn accomplished something astounding. She won a World Cup downhill race in St. Moritz, Switzerland. This makes her the oldest skier, male or female, to win a World Cup race.
4 years older than any man who managed the feat.
And the truly miraculous part is that she achieved this on a knee she had described as broken beyond repair when she retired back in 2019.
That knee was surgically rebuilt in 2024 using robotic assistance, titanium alloys, and polyethylene components. Her recovery was perfect. She no longer experiences pain and now feels better than she has in 15 years, positioning her as a legitimate medal contender for the Winter Olympics.
She now has 83 World Cup victories, second only to Mikaela Shiffrin among women, and three shy of the all-time men's record. A remarkable display of human resilience and medical technology working together.
Finally, let's dive into the perennial source of frustration for NFL fans, the catch rule. We have another classic case of chaos following the controversial overrule of a Ravens touchdown catch by tight end Isaiah Likely.
The specific reversal hinged entirely on the obscure third aspect of the catch rule, which requires a player to complete the act common to the game, or what they call a football move, after securing the ball.
And Likely secured the ball, took two full steps, and extended the ball away from the defender, which the rulebook itself explicitly lists as an acceptable football move.
So what was the technical reason for the incompletion?
The replay officials decided he lost control before his third step landed. This technicality completely negated the spirit of the rule and the common sense of the play.
Ravens coach John Harbaugh, like many fans, was justifiably frustrated, stating the rule is about as clear as mud right now.
And when the explanation for why a clear catch is not a catch requires citing rulebook subsections and micro-analysis of slow-motion video, the sport is arguably suffering from technological overreach.
It's proof that humans can overthink the spirit of the game when given enough slow-motion video and bureaucratic regulations. A theme, frankly, that runs throughout today's deep dive, whether we're talking about the NFL or the Fish Disco.
These cultural absurdities lead us to our final segment, addressing the geopolitical and philosophical debates shaping global perspectives.
I'll start with a surprisingly optimistic view on the U.S.-Israel relationship from Israeli Ambassador Yekiel Leiter. He sees the recent hostility directed at Israel from both the American left and right as part of a necessary political balancing act that will eventually push both sides toward the center.
What he calls the center of the horseshoe.
Right. Leiter, who's a Scranton, Pennsylvania native and served as Netanyahu's chief of staff, credits the prime minister's free market reforms in the 2000s, specifically deregulation and privatization, for providing Israel with the economic strength needed to sustain recent conflicts.
He specifically cited Israel's robust energy independence, noting they are about to sign a $35 billion gas deal supplying Egypt.
His core argument is that the U.S.-Israel relationship is evolving from one-way aid to a real strategic partnership. He cited the recent high-level intelligence collaboration during the Iran strikes as proof.
He noted that Israel took the initial risk and the U.S. completed the operations. He said officials were laughing that news outlets were reporting daylight between Trump and Netanyahu when the actual operational cooperation was extremely deep.
Leiter's long-term vision is an extended Abraham Accords, which he argues would allow the U.S. to gradually reduce its military footprint as Israel and its regional neighbors take over security responsibility.
He advocates for a shift from military financial assistance to military collaboration, specifically proposing a Golden Dome collaboration.
The Golden Dome would mirror the success of the Iron Dome missile defense system. It would involve Israeli technology benefiting U.S. missile defense, transforming Israel into a technological partner rather than just a financial recipient.
And Leiter views Israel as America's only realistic strategic way out of the Middle East, freeing the U.S. to shift focus entirely toward the Far East.
That desire for a strategic pivot to the Far East is exactly what Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, criticized in a letter regarding President Trump's national security strategy.
McFaul argues the NSS is dangerously flawed because its heavy orientation toward the Western Hemisphere, focusing on issues like Venezuela, ignores the primary existential threats posed by nuclear peer adversaries.
Specifically, China and Russia.
Right. He finds that pretending the threats in Asia and Europe can be ignored while focusing on the Caribbean feels like 1930s-era foolishness.
McFaul stressed that to compete effectively with China and Russia, the U.S. needs strong, loyal, enduring allies. He argues the current NSS insults European allies while failing to offer concrete plans to strengthen those partnerships.
McFaul's critique aligns broadly with Peggy Noonan's assessment of Trump's political strategy, where she argues the president may be losing his touch. Polls show his approval has fallen substantially on the economy and immigration since the spring.
Noonan points to the paradox of the border as a key factor. Trump's success in shutting down illegal immigration has, ironically, removed a powerful, unifying political weapon from his arsenal.
So when the border was chaotic, it was a huge unifying issue for the base. Now, she argues, the issue is reduced to the unpopular side of brutal deportation practices, which many Americans, including his base, don't want to see applied to working integrated immigrants.
So solving a major political problem, in her view, removes a powerful political tool.
And she also criticizes what she calls Trump's blindness to AI. She argues he sees it only as competition and growth, showing no apparent plan to regulate it or address the public's profound anxiety about job loss.
By giving the AI brawligarchs carte blanche, he is missing a massive source of the economic unease felt across America.
Moving from geopolitics to the individual economic fate, a new study from the Cleveland Federal Reserve has raised serious questions about the diminishing value of a four-year college degree.
Let's break down the data for you, the listener. The study found that the unemployment gap between high school graduates and college graduates, specifically in the 22 to 27 age group, has tightened dramatically to just 2.5 percentage points.
That gap was roughly 5 percentage points in previous decades.
The implication for a young learner is stark. The study suggests that young college graduates who become unemployed are now more likely to remain unemployed than their high school graduate peers.
The labor market advantage conferred by a four-year degree is eroding quickly.
And the reason for this tightening gap? The study attributes it to the continued growth in college attainment, adding ever larger cohorts of college graduates to the ranks of job seekers, essentially flooding the market.
This data directly supports the public perception. 63% of Americans now believe a four-year degree is not worth the cost.
Finally, we turn to the profound ethical and policy debates surrounding assisted suicide in New York, where a legislative bill is pending before Governor Kathy Hochul.
Opponents of the bill, particularly disability rights groups like the Brooklyn Center for Independence of the Disabled, warn that legalizing assisted suicide based on a life expectancy under 6 months creates a dangerous double standard.
They argue that this legislation inherently values the lives of people with disabilities less than the able-bodied.
They fear that people with disabilities will be seen as an economic burden, leading to the terrible irony summarized by one writer. If you seek to end your life, will you get support or strife? Healthy people meet resistance. Sick old people get assistance.
So they're arguing that suicide prevention is being offered to one group while suicide assistance is being offered to another.
Right. And Governor Hochul has suggested safeguards, but the record in other jurisdictions is a profound warning. 6 of the 12 U.S. jurisdictions that legalized it have since loosened their initial criteria.
The most extreme example is Canada, which abandoned the terminal illness requirement, leading to assisted suicide becoming the 5th leading cause of death there.
So opponents question why Hochul, who has made suicide prevention a hallmark of her administration, would simultaneously open a new avenue for it.
That tension between profound moral choice and catastrophic unintended risk brings us back to the final existential thought raised in our sources regarding nuclear war deterrence.
This comes from an opinion piece critiquing the popular Netflix drama, A House of Dynamite, which the filmmakers misleadingly market as journalism. The critique focuses on how dangerous it is for popular media to poorly ground complex realities like nuclear deterrence.
The movie grossly understates the necessary interceptors and suggests an implausible, out-of-the-blue retaliation against 3 separate powers.
And the core risk, the author argues, is that encouraging unreasoning nuclear dread actually benefits adversaries like Vladimir Putin. He uses implausible nuclear threats to make the world safe for conventional operations, increasing global chaos. This normalized dread, paradoxically, actually increases the risk of actual confrontation by confusing the complex, nuanced principles of deterrence.
And that dynamic leads us to the final, provocative thought for you to consider, based on those complex principles of nuclear deterrence. The fundamental ethical argument suggests it would be morally wrong to fire a full nuclear arsenal if a massive, unstoppable attack were already incoming, because doing so would simply ensure the total global carnage and the devastation of a planetary ecosystem on which all human life depends.
Yet, for deterrence to remain effective, for the strategic balance that has prevented a major global war for 80 years to continue working, it remains supremely important that our enemies believe a U.S. president, nevertheless, would launch that retaliatory civilization-ending strike. This is the moral paradox of our age, a necessary contradiction that every leader must uphold in those few moments before the world might be incinerated.
An incredibly heavy yet vital question to leave you with, and one that underscores the complex, high-stakes decisions we've unpacked across the spectrum today, from Washington appointments and golf courses to the fate of the planet. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor. We'll see you next time.